This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Google has an ambitious mission to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, and a famously ambitious motto, do no evil. The California company revolutionized the search engine, then it branched into email, or Gmail as it calls it, online shopping, videos, and maps. Google is known for its minimalist interface and for its ease of use, but privacy advocates say that convenience comes at a cost. Google hangs on to billions of web pages, and it collects data about what sites are the most popular and about who visits them. Other sites do this kind of collection, too, but Google is by far the biggest, and it's beginning to hear skeptical questions that go straight to the issue of trust. Why, some ask, is Google peeking into Windows? Why, others ask, does Google install computer cookies with a lifespan of 30 years? Later on in the hour, an intimate portrait of June Carter Cash. But first, Google versus evil. How has the Internet changed our definition of privacy, and how has Google facilitated that change? 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation. Declan McCullough is a correspondent for CNET.com in San Francisco. He joins us from a studio at CNET, and nice to talk to you again, Declan.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And when I mentioned Google peeking into Windows, I was talking about a new feature that just became available last month called Google Street View. What is it? How does it work?
Sure. Google launched Street View about 2 weeks ago, just over 2 weeks ago, on I think May 29th. And what it does is it compiles images taken at street level from this sort of camera-equipped white van that has prowled all of America's major cities. And then you can type in an address, go to maps.google.com, and click on Street View, and you can see if you're lucky or unlucky and Google's vans have driven down your street, you can see a photo of the front of your home or workplace that's been taken probably in the last 6 or 9 months.
And the purposes of this is, if you were looking for an apartment on that street, you might want to know what it looks like.
Exactly. You can say, well, maybe I do want to buy this home or at least go to an open house. Maybe this is a business I'm trying to find. That's what it is in real life. Now I know what it's going to look like when I drive down the street in my car.
And you can understand how some people regard this as very cool, very useful, while others say it's just a little bit creepy because it does look into some people's windows and there are people caught coming out of stores they might not want to be caught coming out of.
Exactly right. It's interesting. If you take snapshots of a moment in time on hundreds or thousands of streets, you're going to find some interesting things going on. There have been people caught or maybe photographed leaving strip clubs, scaling walls in what looks like an attempt at a burglary, things like that. And so it does raise more issues than just having, say, an overhead view of the city.
And this privacy issue, Google's accumulating a massive amount of information in a variety of formats, including this one we're talking about, videos, photos, text from books. Why is it doing this vast data grab?
That's a question maybe best posed for Google, but let's try to walk through this. I mean, at some point, Google wants to organize the world's information. And so a lot of what it does at some level has privacy implications. It's main search tool. It's blog search tool. You can search for your name.
Mm-hmm.
Orkut, the social networking site, Gmail, Street View. But so far, people seem to think that the benefits of these services outweigh any privacy costs.
Now, the other hand is that they hold on to this information for a long time because that's the way their search engine works best, isn't it?
Yes, there are some good reasons to hold on to information for a while. I was interviewing the fellow who runs pbwiki.com, a wiki website, a creating tool, and he says, we love to hold on to this information because then we can go back and look at trends over time, look at what people used what service, portions of our service, and improve it. And so there are good business justifications for keeping the information. The problem is, though, that Google, until recently, has kept it forever. Now they're saying they're going to start deleting it. They're going to do some limited anonymization after 18 months. Other search engines like AOL say they're going to do this after just a few months, mm-hmm. I think 90 days.
And Google did that, at least in part, from urging from lawsuits in Europe.
Exactly right. They probably wouldn't have adopted that kind of time limit in the absence of pressure from regulators, because until then, their position was, you never know when this data is going to come in handy.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I do a web search with Google, does it remember that I went to Amazon.com 6 times last month?
Yes and no. A big question is whether you log in to Google. In other words, create an account that you can use for Gmail, for instance, or if you have Google's ads on your blog.
Mm-hmm.
If you create an account, then Google is going to have your email address, and then it's going to probably know what you've done across multiple sites and correlate that with your email address. If you don't have a Google account, then it will still set a cookie, but it'll just say that this person did these searches, and it won't necessarily have an email address or personally identifiable information tied to it. That's why a lot of us recommend that people don't allow Google.com to set cookies, or go in frequently and wipe the cookies, so then Google can't correlate your searches over multiple visits.
All right. Explain to those of us who are idiots, what's a cookie?
Netscape coined the term in the mid-1990s. What it is, it's a small data file that's placed on your computer so that you can go back to Google. Let's use the New York Times as an example. When you go to the New York Times and you pay for the Time Select feature, it's a pain to log in every time you go there and type in your username and password.
Sure.
And so what you can do is let nytimes.com set a cookie. It remembers who you are, and then the next time you come back, you don't have to do that again. This is much the same way that a maitre d' at a good restaurant is going to remember repeat customers and provide sort of a customized experience. That's at least the beneficial aspects of cookies.
And there are some people who wonder, why is Google designing cookies that have a lifespan of 30 years?
It's actually a lot of websites do that. It's not uncommon to use the maximum default cookie value. That's sort of geek speak for let's just let the cookies last as long as we can.
Right.
But it's true. There's no reason that Google necessarily has to do that, and it could have the cookies expire just after a month, a year, whatever they like.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. We're talking with Declan McCullough from CNET.news.com. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. CNETnews.com. I'll get the organization right in the third try. And let's get JV on the line. JV's with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hi. My question was related maybe more to cookies in general as the topic for your show entailed, essentially related to, though I have no ill will towards Google, I don't necessarily appreciate the fact that they would place cookies on my computer, whether I would authorize it or not. As a means for consumers to sort of fight back, as it were, would it be an effective tool to charge for the storage of those data files on our hard disks and for the time that they're stored there?
So does Google owe us money for keeping its storage, some stuff stored on our computer? Declan McCullough.
The short answer is probably not. I mean, there's no hard and fast rule, but the way the internet has grown up over the last 10 or 15 years has been that cookies are allowed by default, and you can block them if you want. Every major browser has the option of blocking cookies. You can go to Safari or preferences and just say don't allow these certain sites to set cookies. I should say that it's not unique, and Google's length is not that unique. Apple's cookies expire in 2012, Yahoo's 2037, and NPR's in 2020. So it's not just Google that's doing this. It's sometimes useful to know who your visitors are, so then they can set preferences and things like that on your site.
Our cookies taste better, though. JV, thanks very much for the call.
No, thank you. Bye.
So long. Let's see if we can go to, this is Aaron. Aaron's with us from Davis, California.
Hi, am I on there?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I work for a small private investigation firm that services the Northern California Bay Area, and as well as the Inland Valley and whatnot. And we found Google Streetwise to be very useful, actually, the last 3 weeks in finding residences of people we've been contracted to perform surveillance on. So we're not actually finding the people themselves, but when we send an investigator out, that about, you know, helps us greatly in locating their residence, so we know where to set up and whatnot. So Google certainly got one happy customer here.
And this is presumably for San Francisco?
Yes, they don't have coverage all over the Bay Area yet, but we've been able to find some claimants' addresses in San Francisco, as well as parts of the South Bay. Every day, you know, you log on, there's a little more of the map that's covered. And, yeah, we think it's great, and we can't wait till there's more coverage.
Uh-huh. Okay. I guess, Declan McCullough, there's a usage I hadn't anticipated.
Exactly.
Same here.
Bye-bye.
All right, Aaron, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. It's interesting. Let's see if we can get Peter on the line. Peter's calling us from Berkeley.
Hi.
Hey.
I wanted to make a contribution. I think the key question in these kinds of discussions, how do we define evil? And one contribution is to know that the root word, upo, actually meant to exceed proper limits.
And do you suspect that Google perhaps has exceeded proper limits here?
I wouldn't single out Google. I would like to make a comment that I've tried on my browser selecting that option where you can individually approve whether a cookie is planted or not.
Uh-huh.
But if you choose that, on some sites, for instance, AOL, just as an example, I'm sure they're not unique, but I just get deluged and paralyzed by all the cookies that are trying to be planted by one advertiser after another, and I can't recognize who it is, and this goes on and on, and you can't get to the what you were doing. And
yeah.
It's really quite offensive.
And Declan McCullough reinforces a point you made earlier. A lot of companies and a lot of sites do this. It's Google that's the biggest.
Sure. Well, maybe so. But, I mean, they could make a contribution to mediating this process. I know they're one of the biggest players. And I would like to have the option to be able to individually approve or disapprove the planting of a cookie, and I would like to be able to understand who's doing it instead of just some abbreviation that I can't understand.
So you'd like to see more transparency, so to speak.
Yes, and also not get absolutely flooded, you know, like a waterfall crashing down on my head of all these requests to plant cookies. There should be some limit on the user's experience, while retaining choice, but not being completely overwhelmed by these choices.
Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
More on Google and you when we come back. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. New technology can make our lives easier, but convenience can come at a cost. As one of the biggest names in tech, Google often finds itself singled out as an example. The company is still taking heat from regulators in Europe. They say Google has not gone far enough to protect user privacy. Here at home, some people complain that their photo or images of their home showed up on Google's new street-level maps, and they want no part of it. Still, there is no shortage of people signing up to use Google's services. Declan McCullough is still with us. He's correspondent for CNetNews.com. We'll talk with Google's deputy general counsel in a couple of minutes. How has the Internet changed our definition of privacy? And how has Google contributed to those changes? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Check out our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now is Frank Pasquale. He teaches at Seton Hall Law School in Newark, New Jersey, and specializes in privacy issues and cyber law. He's with us from our bureau in New York. And Professor Pasquale, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
And most people who use Google services, like Gmail or the calendar, have to sign up for a Google account, which requires forfeiting some personal information. But you have to click to agree to terms of service. Are there legal grounds to complain about any invasion of privacy if you sign up for it? And of course, 99 out of 100 of us don't read that that stuff anyway.
Sure, absolutely. And I think a lot of these, they're often called browse wrap contracts because they're a lot like the shrink wrap you get on your software. Once you open it, you're supposed to have agreed to the whole contract.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people obviously are not reading through the whole end user license agreement and that whole contract. However, the courts have generally held people to be bound by the terms of the agreement that they click on. And so it's very difficult once you've entered into that essential contract with Google to go after them. However, there are some other issues that are opened up by people, say, who are using the service but have not particularly signed on for a particular account in the mm-hmm. service. Like if I just get it up on my computer and put up the Google search box.
Right. But if you sign up for the calendar, you automatically have to have an account.
Sure. Yes.
And same thing for Gmail and other things. Then there are people who don't sign up for anything, but nevertheless may find pictures of themselves or their house on Google's website.
Absolutely. And that raises some very interesting issues that the Europeans and Quebec have sort of – these countries have anticipated some of these issues and actually have some laws, some regulations against the commercial use of these sorts of photos of individuals without their permission. In the U.S. in general, that's not an issue. And if someone does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the front of their house or, you know, one publicized case of their cat looking out the window, someone complained about that being online.
Sure.
There are a few states, though, like Texas does have a very odd law that says that if you take a photo of someone for prurient interest, you know, that could raise some issues in Texas. So it'd be very interesting to see how some of these individual state laws might come into play here.
And has the U.S. government gotten involved with Google on privacy issues?
It has, but rather indirectly. The Federal Trade Commission back in 1999 sort of has been a bit of a privacy entrepreneur and has started looking into some of the issues involved here. But it's all being done a bit indirectly. I mean, there's some pressure, and even with a new DoubleClick purchase, there's some concerns raised by the FTC, which is both an antitrust and a privacy watchdog.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, in the U.S., it's been a pretty hands-off approach.
And the other question is, people fear what Google might do with this information in terms of selling it or making it available to people. They also worry that this information, all this information about them, might be accessed by some outsider, whether that's the government with a warrant or whether that's a hacker with a very good program.
Absolutely. And that is an area where Google, to its credit, has been way in front of some other search engines in terms of trying to stop the government subpoena last year when it tried to connect IP addresses to the search records or when it tried to, to get search records in its defense of the Child Online Protection Act.
That was looking for child pornography.
Yes, exactly. Well, this was an act that was involved in trying to shield children from pornography, and the government was trying to prove essentially that lots of random searches that would be totally innocent could come up with these types of images, and they wanted to look through all of Google's files. Now, of course, Google said that when it did this, it was trying to protect users' privacy, and perhaps it had standing to do that. But I think a larger concern of Google, and I think this is a larger public concern, is that it was protecting its trade secrets.
Mm-hmm.
It's very keen on protecting its trade secrets, how it organizes the data, how it puts it together, all those things.
Which argues that its argument against the transparency that one of our callers was going into earlier. And Declan McCullough, every organization says, well, we've made every effort to protect our files. No outsider could possibly get into it until that happens.
It's true. History has a lot of examples of people saying, oh, this is unbreakable or this is invulnerable. And then, of course, the privacy is violated. But to Google's credit, they have not yet suffered the kind of data breach that we're talking about. Maybe it's just a matter of time, or maybe that they have done the right thing. The one interesting point, though, is that we use search engines nowadays as sort of our window into the world, or at least our window onto the internet. And so if you look at someone's search history over time, you can glean quite a bit of information about people. Google search terms have popped up in a criminal case, a North Carolina murder case. The defendant was found guilty in part because he searched for words like neck, snap, break. And it was his wife that turned up dead. Another wireless hacking case. The Google search terms involved things like wireless interference. And so there is a privacy threat inherent in any organization, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, or whatnot, collecting that much information and then making it available because of our legal system to prosecutors in a criminal case or civil litigants, even divorce lawyers in a civil case.
So what you're suggesting is, in fact, that we ought to see that we're going into a public space when we do this, whether we have an account or not, whether we go on Google, and that indeed our activities can, under certain circumstances, be reported.
It's true. And so this is a reason to apply probably market pressure on companies to at least be clear about what they're doing with this data, when they're going to delete it. AOL deletes logs of searches, they tell me, after 90 days. Why does Google only and partially anonymize, not even completely delete, after 18 months? Why not? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they follow AOL's lead in this case, for instance?
And well, there's actually some reasons why they wouldn't, and that's because they're often required to retain data by authorities both in the U.S. and Europe.
But there's no data retention law in the U.S. Congress has debated it but has not passed it, so Google doesn't need to do that in the U.S.
And Frank Pasquale, this idea that expectation of privacy when you enter in a Google search, there is some expectation of privacy, I would think.
That's a very interesting legal standard, and I think that's going to be part of a big cultural war. And I like the way that Declan has brought up the idea of market pressure. I think there's also got to be some sort of cultural movement, like the cultural movement that ultimately led to some legislation on things like Choice Point or the credit reporting agencies and other massive compilers of digital dossiers.
Mm. Let's get to another caller on the line, and this is David. David's with us from Reno, Nevada.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
And my question is for people like me who sign up for a Hotmail account or any type of account, I never use my real information as far as name, address, or anything like that. And when I have to use credit cards or enter it in, I still don't use my real information. And how does that affect people like me still?
Presumably that credit card number's got to be real, or you're not going to get the doily you've ordered for your aunt.
Well, the thing is frequently you can use a credit card over the internet without putting your real name.
Ah, your real name. Okay. Declan McCullough, I think there may be other people just as clever as David out there.
Maybe. I don't think I quite understood the question, but if you're worried about using your credit card over the internet, many retailers will let you call up and give it to them over the phone. But in reality, what seems to be happening in the data breach cases that we're seeing and we're writing about is not so much the information being captured in transit. It's more that the backup tape goes missing or someone breaks into the database. So even if you call up someone on the phone, that information could still end up being divulged.
Yeah,
I can't imagine why anybody like me today would use any of their real information, such as their home address or anything, when filling out these required things. I never do. And if I use a search that
Frank Pasquale, let's ask you this expectation of privacy that people have. I guess there are ways like David has to get around it, but ultimately this is not going to work for most of us.
Indeed, and perhaps from his example, it might be a bit unnerving.
It might be, yes, indeed.
So I think that in general, I mean, it's very interesting in terms of the expectation of privacy, and there are some programs out there, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and some other, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, have done some things in these areas. There's a program called Tor that might give people some chance of anonymizing themselves out there. But in general, it is your IP address is a real address, and it is connected to you, and it's connected to your computer by and large. If you're using broadband, you're using the main providers of internet services. So everyone should be concerned about this in the sense that it's very hard to get out of the system.
Let's bring Nicole Wong into the conversation. She's Deputy General Counsel for Google and joins us from the company's headquarters in Mountain View, California. Ms. Wong, you've been very patient. I know you've been listening to this program, and I'm sure there have been several points you wanted to jump in. It's nice to have you available to talk to us now.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity to join.
And a lot of people, as you've heard, are concerned about the information that Google collects about internet use. What does Google collect, and what does the company do with it? And is this proprietary?
So for a lot of our regular users, you're probably aware we have a whole range of different types of products. The one that we're most well known for is our search engine. But we also, as was mentioned earlier in the program, we have an email service. We have things like Google Earth, and mm-hmm. we have a number of other interesting new products. One of the things that we really try to do is to design all of our products with transparency and choice built into the product. And what I mean by that is that when you use one of our products, we try to design it so that you are aware of what type of information is being collected and how it's being used. An example of that would be what is called our Google Toolbar. It's a toolbar that helps you and attaches to your browser. Before you can even download it, a little window will pop up and it says in big, bright red letters, please read this. It's not the usual yada yada. And it tells you exactly what we're going to do. That's an example of trying to be transparent with our users and also letting them make a different choice, which is they don't want to download the toolbar. One of the things we also try to do is have a range of our products that are available without having to sign in or provide us with any personally identifying information. Certain types of things, you can't do that, right? If you sign up with an email
sure.
account, you have to.
Yeah. You talked about transparency. An earlier caller, I'm sure you heard, mentioned this this problem that, as he sees it, of cookies that are last for 30 years. Are they transparent? Do we know that they're coming? Do we know who originated them? Do we know what they do?
So one of the solves for cookies getting onto your computer is, I think Declan was mentioning it, you can set your browser not to accept certain types of cookies. And we do allow for users to use our services without having to have that cookie at all. We initially set that cookie because what it means is that a user, as they come back to our site again and again, they don't have to reset their preferences all the time. That mm-hmm. cookie is there to sort of set your language preference so that if you want to see it in French instead of English, that can happen. It also does things like set what we call our safe search filter so that you only see things that would be appropriate for children, not necessarily.
Those aren't the only things they do, though.
Sure. Well, for the cookie, that's the primary thing is to set your preferences, and of course you don't have to use it at all.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Google privacy and you. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me just continue with Nicole Wong. With Street View, can users ask that photographs be taken down if they say, look, I didn't want my cat or whatever it was in this picture?
I know that was one of the issues, was a cat visible in a window. Yes, we actually we thought really hard before we launched this product, and we're still looking at, even after post-launch, to take a lot of feedback, both from our users and from folks like Declan and privacy advocates and regulators. This product was built with a feature to flag content that you don't want in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will review all of those flags and remove the ones that are inappropriate.
And is the goal eventually to have every street and byway in America on this service?
Oh, well, that would really be useful, we think, to all of our users to have all those streets. It's a very large project, obviously.
Obviously. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Casey. Casey with us from Rapid City in South Dakota.
Hi. I just kind of have a comment that I wanted to point out. I think it's so many times we try to hold the big companies responsible for making our stuff private, but I think a lot of users might not even realize that the Internet is a public place, and if you are going to Google.com or Yahoo.com, that you are in a public place where some information is going to be seen. And it seems like so many times I see people whining about their privacy and that they want this to be private. Well, most of the time that relates back to they don't want what they're doing to be seen in public, which is,
right.
You know, and it seems to me like they're doing something that they're embarrassed of or whatever. So if you're not going to do it in public, why would you?
They're doing something you want to keep private. And I guess that goes back to we raised this earlier with Frank Pasquale. But Nicole Wong, is there an expectation of privacy if I go on the Google search page and put in whatever it is?
Well, and then
we're trying to get an answer from the Google representative here. Excuse me, Casey. Go ahead, please.
Okay, sorry.
Sure. I think it always depends on what type of service. Casey's probably thinking about services like MySpace or where people are uploading things that are for public display. And I think that for our Google search pages, again, you can use our Google search system without ever providing us any personally identifying information. We also have a whole privacy center where we do try to be transparent with our users about the type of information collected when you do a search on Google. And we hope that we help them to make meaningful choices by giving them that type of information.
Casey, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Kathy in Illinois. As the owner of a Gmail account, I find it disconcerting to get an email and find ads alongside keyed to the content of the message. I'm an activist and frequently have messages I don't really want everyone reading. What's the process that Gmail uses to key into the content of my emails? Does someone, many ones, actually have access to the content of my messages? Can companies buy access to my emails?
I'll take that one. So it's important to clear up any sort of misunderstanding about how Gmail works. No person is reading those emails in order to match ads to it. It's completely by computer. And it works very similarly to the way our search technology works, which is that the computer will identify a keyword in the content of an email. And it will simply look in our system of ads and find the thing most relevant to that keyword. When you close your email, all of record of whatever ads showed on the side disappear. There are no footprints left based on that. So in a lot of ways, compared to other free webmail services where when you sign up, you have to give them information about demographics, like what age, what gender, what income level, and your interests, because that's how they're going to target their ads to you and their free service. Ours are really only targeted on information that we're already holding for you because we are your email service provider.
Because you are the emails, and we've signed up for that account, and we should have read all that stuff. All right. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us, Ms. Wong.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Wong, Deputy General Counsel at Google, joined us by phone from Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California. We'll take a couple of more of your questions about Google privacy and you with Declan McCullough and with Frank Pasquale when we come back. Also, when we come back, we're going to be talking with John Carter Cash, who's written an intimate portrait of his mother, June Carter Cash. Stick around for that. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's continue our conversation about Google privacy and you. Our guests are Declan McCullough, a correspondent with CNetNews.com, and Frank Pasquale, associate professor of law at Seton Hall. And they're both with us. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Amanda. Amanda's with us from Salt Lake City.
Hi. My question is whether it's possible to have links to yourself that pop up on like the Google search. Can you have those removed? I had done some interviews with a school newspaper regarding some health issues, and now a friend of mine pointed out to me that they Googled my name and some really personal information came up that's been published even like across the nation, mm-hmm. different places have picked it up. Is it possible to get those links removed?
Declan McCullough, would you like to tell her no?
Yeah, I don't think the news is good on this point. The problem is not so much Google, it's just making the information easier to find. The problem is with the publisher that put the information on in the first place. It sounds like it might be a student newspaper, and you gave an interview to them. And so you're going to have to go back and say, hey, can you either take this offline or add a tag or something to it. One technique is called robots.txt to say that article will still exist on our site but will not be indexed by search engines. So go back and talk to the newspaper and say, look, I know you have no legal obligation to do that, but could you as a favor just have it removed from Google?
There's
okay,
also...
I'll try that. Thank you.
Frank Pasquale?
Sure. There's also some other services that you could hire or that you could try yourself just to knock it off the first page, because there's been lots of studies done about internet searchers' usage patterns, and a lot of times people don't go past the first few pages. And so if you hire something like Reputation Defender, there's some other companies out there. They're very new, and they're upstarts, and they've made a few missteps, but they are trying to provide this service where you can at least hide the embarrassing results beneath things that may be more positive or favorable to you.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Amanda.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get, this is John on the line. John's with us from Provo in Utah.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm taking my call. I just had a question and a comment basically about the street level service.
Sure.
Google. I don't really think that it's an invasion of privacy because it's just a more convenient way for me to see what things are like on, say, 171 West Main Street in Cincinnati, Ohio. I could get on a plane and go look at it and take a picture and post it on my own website.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's just a little bit more convenient for me to do that.
Unless the camera peeks in the window and sees something that the owner might not. Well, where do we get into, Frank Pasquale? What's private and what isn't?
Absolutely, and it's a great question. And I think the problem here lies in the ease of use of these types of services. For example, when you just had a lot of digitization of court records. Now, you might have had a court record that would be lying in some vault in a small town that could only be accessed by someone actually getting to that record. And nowadays, you know, there's lots of courts that are putting out their court records out there. And I think that the problem lies not necessarily in the fact that, well, you could have done it anyway, but in the fact that we've reached this point where there's all this data out there and you can't control this digital person, this sort of avatar, second self you've got online.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, a lot of countries are worried about this. Finland has banned the use by employers of Google when they're screening applicants because for precisely this type of worry. You know, and in terms of the street level view, yeah, maybe I don't worry so much about, you know, my house being on it. But think about it. Perhaps I've not mowed the lawn for 2 months. You know, I've been away, and that's the image.
And
that's
you've decided
online.
To sell your house.
Yes, and everyone that goes on Zillow or wherever to see my house says, "Wow, what a dump!" And I think that that's why we need to have more accountability by the search engines in terms of giving us some autonomy in how we present this digital person, this second self that's online.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question. Does Google, is it able to access things that would somebody would place on a MySpace page?
Declan?
It It depends. There's MySpace tends to be a more open environment than, say, Facebook that is more closed. And so MySpace pages tend to appear in Google, and Facebook pages tend not to. So it really depends on how the creator of the social networking site set it up and individual privacy preferences that the users decide on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, John. And we'll end with this email from Maureen. I'm not very computer savvy, so how can I even begin to understand the rights I may be giving away with organizations like Google? Also, it seems that the laws about privacy may be outdated in this new age of electronic information. If I'm walking down the street or standing in front of my house, I am aware that I will be seen by people passing by. I do not expect to have a photo or a video of me to be posted on a website that anyone in the world can view. This seems very wrong to me. And Frank Pasquale, this is where people are getting into levels of discomfort.
Absolutely. And I think that the history of privacy law is a history of how it has dealt with new technologies. And I think we'd be very unwise, just as it was unwise to say in the 1920s that wiretapping wasn't a problem, you know, because it wasn't going actually into somebody's house. That was later overturned, thank goodness. I think that we have to update the paradigms so that we can actually give voice and actually give some substance to these concerns in the law, rather than just telling people, well, do self-help, you know, wear a burqa or something.
Yeah, digitize your own face so it's blurry.
Yes.
Frank Pasquale, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Frank Pasquale, Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall Law School, joined us from our bureau in New York. Declan McCullough, always good to talk with you.
Likewise.
Declan McCullough, correspondent for CNetNews.com, and he joined us today from CNET's headquarters in San Francisco.